Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast, sparking your interest in Australian property and finance. Here's your hosts, Jazz and David.
I need to somehow change my starting line, man. I think it's starting to get boring. All right, I'll kick off.
David, I had a lot of feedback from the listeners. Your opening lines are getting boring. Can you please make it interesting for our listeners as we speak? This is being recorded, by the way, so go accordingly.
Nah, it's all good. All right, I will kick off then. G'day, everyone. Welcome back to another exciting episode of Spark Your Fire. As always, we love investors. And again, we're bringing back another investor story today. I think it's been a few weeks since we've had investors back on, haven't we, Jazz? Or the fact that we haven't covered investor stories, I think that's a good change.
Yeah, it's been a little while. You're right. I was thinking the same thing, David. I mean, we had a lot of other guests on the show lately, talking more about the economy and what's going on at the macro level. Mm-hmm. But it's good to bring back the people on the ground, which is the investors who are doing the daily hard yards.
Oh, 100%. And the funny thing is, before we jump on, I know this investor actually mentioned that we always have a good banter about Sydney and Melbourne. I thought that's we didn't keep the tradition this time. It's a bit disappointing. But anyway, I think it's get to the point where we probably need to start expanding rather than just Sydney and Melbourne. We'll bring in some new competitions as well, given the fact that our guest today is actually situated in Queensland. And I thought it's a good opportunity to introduce David Glover from Blue Gum Properties, who is a buyer's agency and also a developer at the moment. So, David, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, David, and thank you, Jazz. Very nice to meet you guys in the flesh, well, via the video conference finally, because, yes, I'm a New South Welshman, you know, play AFL and lives in Queensland. So I'm going to give you guys heaps about that.
I think the starting point for every listener is, why did you move?
Well, third time lucky, I think is the saying. I just took me 3 times to move to Queensland to finally reside for quite a while. So it's New South Wales, lived in Melbourne for quite a few years, girls were born there, and literally third time back to Queensland, and we've been here for about 5 years now on a 35-acre farm in the southeast Queensland area.
I only need an acre, mate. Acre will do for me. Just somewhere where I don't have to pay the rent.
Well, you guys should, you know, when you have a home, you need to make it an asset. So this farm actually produces adjustment for dressage horses, and currently today we're actually baling hay, which is another little revenue stream that we've got going on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's nice. Cool. Before we jump into the property journey, you have been a rugby player, right? So,
a try-hard league player. So I did grow up playing league, and I did have the privilege to play for University of Newcastle to a good level, and that was a lot of fun and a lot of good mates. And I sort of needed to return to that mateship story, you know, where you play football again, hence Masters, but I couldn't pull the boots on for rugby league. You know, I was just a little too concerned. So I've had a blast playing and learning how to play AFL in the last 3 to 4 years.
You need a certain mindset to be able to compete at that level. Before we dig into your investor story, what's the similarity that you find from that perspective when you're working in your investment space, Dave, and having that mindset of a champion's play? How do you compare the two, if you know what I mean?
This is a great question. It's actually something that I thought a lot about in the last few years. I've done various coaching recently, so as you evolve through your sport and you become coaches, you start to learn how to bring out other people's skill sets, strengths and weaknesses. And then when you have to pull the boots back on yourself and run out on that field, you know, and your kids are playing the same sport, both my son and my daughter play AFL, right? And they see you having to interact with a club, and that's a club network. So that's a skill set in itself, and a mindset of generosity, of abundance, of, you know, putting back into your community. And then when you train a team, you've got to be able to encourage people to get on the field. You've got to handle the nerves. You've got to handle the adrenaline that gets pumping. You've got to handle people and situations. Then you've got to coordinate with your team to, yeah, to play that game and play it in a great spirit. And there are so many things to learn. And funny enough, in my current group of people that I'm doing JVs with, they are actually my fellow footy players. So the mindset that comes from there is amazing, because when you think about it, I trust them so much now, because I've seen them pull the boots on in the shed. I've seen them get hit. I've seen them have to get up off the ground. I've seen them, you know, have good days, bad days. And you've seen a wide range of their behaviours. So now that we do projects together, it's an amazing level of trust that's been developed in that sporting arena.
Yeah. See, it's handling the nerves and having that team who's got a trust in you. Really, that's really hard to build up, and it takes a long time, I guess, for that. So
yeah,
that part.
It's a great question. I hadn't thought about it. Yeah.
That's all. I actually have been lately thinking about, because there's such a competitive mindset that you carry when you're playing sports. There's surely people out there who are now investors and were in sports, and you have been kind of in both those spaces. So it was good to pick your brain on that. Now it's cool. So let's dig into your story a little bit, Dave. So you have been in the property space now for roughly about 20 years or so?
Yeah, a bit more, 26 years now. Shana and I brought our first, it was a deceased estate house. Mm-hmm. When we were at uni, I was a trainee with BHP, and Shana was working in a coal washery. And while we're going to uni, and so working multiple jobs, and we brought our first deceased estate when we were 21, and we kicked off from there. So that was a cosmetic reno, and then we actually then went overseas for a year, but then when we came back, we exchanged that out for a mortgage foreclosure property, 65 acres in the Hunter Valley in the vineyards. And that was a massive cleanup and a new build. And that was pretty exciting to sell that, because that was a massive uplift, that property. And then,
can we just step back a little bit? So the first property, just for listeners, it was, because I know you were originally from Hunter Valley. So it's the first property back in Hunter Valley as well?
Yeah, Newcastle. Yeah.
Newcastle. And how much was that bought for?
Oh, we're back in the days where that was like $107,000 was the purchase price for that, below market, because it was, you literally walked in the door and there was the toilet seat from the gentleman that had, he'd lived there until he passed away. And so that sort of thing, horsehair plaster, no room was square, it was that sort of kickoff, we loved it. We'd spent 3 months prior to that. I lived at Shana's mum's place in a spare back room on the ground, and we'd spent 3 months literally saving every dollar we had to get into that property. Yeah, and but you got to dig in and do that. We never regret that sort of 3 months that it took us to complete getting ready for that purchase, and then we had a guy that acted like a buyer's agent. He was showing us another property who led us to that property and said, I think you can handle this one, mate, and that taught us a lot. It taught us to get that deposit down. We had great inspiration at the time. My great mentor, Ray Keyes, was the one that really inspired me to be able to do that. My parents had never tripped over that line to become investors. They'd had the opportunity but hadn't done it. So we had the inspiration, we had the knowledge, and we had the desire to really save like you wouldn't believe for those 3 months together. And the day we brought it was the day I asked Shana to marry me. So it was awesome. Yeah. We signed that contract and we went
and signed the other piece of paper too.
True.
So what made you go into the property, Dave? What was the trigger to actually go and start this journey?
Yeah. I hadn't no one in my family had really ever bought an investment property. So I never grew up with that investor mindset. Absolute burning desire inside me to head off and build a business or or to, you know, go hard in some sort of career, which was engineering for me at the time. And what happened was my mentor, great mentor, Ray Keyes, was the guy that he would we'd rock up and he would get me to help him fix this block of units, right? So he taught me to replace carpets, to paint, to fix lights, to do all sorts of things, right? And it dawned on me that Ray owned all of that unit complex. And he had retired when he was 45. And so we rode horses together. That's partly part of my story with my wife. And Ray was very close to us, gave Chandra away at his wedding. He actually hosted our reception after the wedding at his place. And Ray's inspiration, very quiet man. He led by what he did, not what he said. And, so that inspiration, having seeing what people can do. Ray was just been a tradie in the TAFE, and he'd served, you know, for the Air Force, and they brought shops, haberdashery type of stuff. He'd sold buttons. He was well known at what, you know, people would walk in to buy their wool, and him and Lorna, were the ones that showed me, not told me, but showed me, and that lit a fire like you wouldn't believe under me. So carries on to this day.
David, if you want to continue, I need a charger, mate. I forgot to bring my charger.
Okay, no worries. Okay, so that's interesting, Dave, I have to say. So essentially that's what having a good mentor at that point in time, Ray basically was the one that gave you the inspiration to basically accumulate a proper portfolio and to lead you with the concept of financial independence, retire early. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're really close, David. So Ray showed me what he had, but he wasn't a good communicator about it. I've often reflected since to wonder why. So Ray would struggle to talk numbers, or so we're still in that generation, and so was I, where you didn't really talk about your assets or your money or how to structure things. So we unfortunately fell for that initial trap where I only thought that you would buy, fix, renovate, and then you would sell. So I constantly kept selling as I built up that first sort of 8 or 9 projects that we did. And I regret that so much, right? But at the end of the day, so he showed me. We never had a financial conversation in our life. And and so that gap between the knowledge was then up to – I'm a big reader, and so I like everyone else's journey. I probably read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I connected to that. Yep. It taught me more than about especially that concept about evolving from an employee to a business and an investor. And for a long time I was a little confused about that, where now I've certainly moved into both realms as an investor and now a business owner. That's my journey is into another quadrant now, and off we go. So, but geez, I wish I could go back 15 years and sit down probably learn a few more things that, they still struggled socially, I think, to talk about topics like, you know, investing and money and stuff like that. Mm. And to a long degree, it took me a long time. It took my best mate, Robbie Roth, to extract that out of me. At one point, he came up looking for investment property. We spent a day looking at these things in, you know, Brisbane South, and I got really frustrated. I needed to go, you know, via one of my projects. We called in there, and Robbie looked at my project and the cash flow, and he said, "Wow, man!" I'm like, that was the first day I ever explained to anybody what I'd learned about investing and cash flow, and that. Yeah, Rob taught me a lot from that conversation, and I think I never had that chance with Ray to do that. But you have to first you get inspired, and then after that you've got to learn, and then you've got to get on the tools yourself, and then you become a true investor in other people doing that, and then you have a business which runs the systems to do that. So massive evolution, yeah.
All the properties, or most of the properties that you dealt with, post that were renovations or developments kind of thing?
No, I got into subdivision pretty quickly. So we had a of our 4-acre place at Beenleigh, which I got a 10 block onto. And my desire as an engineer was to build 10 houses, right? But I got knocked back. Well, that's when the finance crash happened with the first lot of the Commonwealth Bank brokers. And so we couldn't get our dollars to build. And so we sold that project with the DA in place. And I made a lot of money from the DA. So I was like, wow, that was awesome. Like that was a quick velocity of money and fairly low risk. I enjoyed it. And that taught me a lot about setting up projects and running them as projects. And I didn't have to do cosmetic reno or anything on that one, right? So, and then I did some unit splits. So we brought a couple of houses on the same title and we did just title changes. Now, that is a great way to make money. And they already had tenants in there. You don't disturb them. You get cash flow while you make $100,000 on the equity. So, yeah, you learn as you go along that there's other ways. So, yes, I'm a huge believer that you have to have a portfolio of 2 to 3 behind you and you accumulate them by cosmetic renos or subdivisions. And that's, you know, what I'm passionate about, like to help people find that cosmetic reno, that splitter or that simple subdivision. That gives you resilience. We've noticed that, right? Like in the last 6 months while everyone's freaking out, you know, I've got a portfolio, highly cash flowed, highly resilient, and you don't stress. And I've had great relations with my tenants the whole way through. In fact, with one of them today, we're actually doing a cosmetic reno because, you know, he's out of work. And so we're painting the house. It's really cool, right? So there's all sorts of things that when you have positive cash flow properties and a couple of them, it takes the stress out of a lot of situations for you and your tenants. And then it frees up your creativity to get into your joint venture projects and things like that. And so you've got to, you know, that's a lot more education and skill sets and experience, but it's still a great utilization of property knowledge and skills to achieve what your goals are, really. Yeah.
How many years in between?
We would have been, so Hunter was born, so we're talking about 30. So so we're only kind of 10 years into our journey. It was beautiful. I looked at Southeast Queensland. We looked at 3 properties. I totally wiped the first 2, looked at the third one. It was next to a school. Obviously, you know, it would be, you know, subdividable in a good area. Suited our needs for the first couple of years while we had the kids there. So Hunter was born in Brisbane and, you know, we raised them there while we were working here. And then when we went to Adelaide on a mining project, I did the DA while I was in Adelaide and sold the project. So you've just got to flex your needs and what you're doing to – but it was great. You know, I learned because – I got too blinded. I was going to build 10 houses. It was a massive desire. You got to understand, as an engineer, right? We want to build stuff. It's like Lego Masters, right? You just want to build. So too fixated, you know, wanted to build, got my, you know, sort of like head slapped when the mortgage broking issue happened. And it was like, so then I had to learn how to emotionally deal with the knockback. And then I had to go, oh, hang on. It was the first time I learned if I can't go over something, I'll go around it or I'll go under it. So I've never let a problem, you know, come up in one of my projects never stop me. Now, it was the day I learned to be flexible, to just keep chugging and get creative. And a no is not a no, you know. It's just means you need an alternate path. And so I'm really good now at alternate pathways. So
the vision is set. Once the vision is set, doesn't matter which path you take, there can be multiple paths and you keep chopping along the way to decide which one is the right one depending upon the situation.
Yep, back to your mindset, I think. That's it. You've got to have faith. You've got to believe where you're headed to. And, yep, different roads. Some of them are pretty hard to get through, you know, and some of them are thorny and some of them are nicely paved, you know, none with gold yet, but that might come. So
that was a good story as well. And I think a lot of listeners would resonate with that because, you know, essentially when you buy a block of land and you already can envision that you've got your, you know, the Dave Empire with 10 townhouses sitting on there, you know, just imagine how beautiful that would look like. But ultimately, let me ask you a hypothetical question. If you decided to, let's say, for example, if you're able to get the finance for that 10 houses or 10 townhouses at that time versus what you've done, in other words, just subdivide and or put a DA on it and then essentially sell it off, what would be more profitable?
Which approach would it be? Selling at the DA stage. The velocity of money for me is incredible versus when you do go through to build product, then you've got a lot of tax planning to do. You've got to sell down. You've got to delay in timing, and you expose yourself to market risk. So if you're in a project for 2 years, so I mitigate that now. So when I do build, so we're currently one project that we're doing, which is going to build, and but I've already forward sold those blocks to the builder on builder's terms. So when you get into something like that, you really have to be mitigating all those forward risks that you just can't envisage. So I've even got creative on that end of the project as well. So it's a good question because I was devastated, but then it ended up being the best thing because I popped out of that and I went into a cosmetic real estate. It was a garden fix up actually in Mount Gravatt in Brisbane, and that was $100,000 profit in a year just buying well. Doing it was in a premium estate, and it had a gut. It was supposed to be an 800 meter block, but it was surrounded by 3 meters of bamboo, massive bamboo trees, right? And really thick. And so it literally took me 2 months of chainsawing. Good thing I grew up on a farm. Took me 2 months to actually pull all of that stuff out of that property, and 20-40 tips to the to the tip, right? But you've got to see what you're after, and then you got to just get in and do it and enjoy it.
How would you approach the current market? Basically, have the things changed in the last month or two since this with this coronavirus? Obviously, the market we all know has slowed down a bit. There aren't those many transactions happening. Do you think the market is going to change significantly from there of the way things are done, or it will still be old school days the way we have been doing it in the past for the people who are actively seeking out things right now?
Yeah, it's changed. It's changed dramatically. Anyone that thinks that now you can just buy a property and hope for growth, they are in massive trouble. Like it'll take us a while to get cash flowing back through the economy. Just things have changed. So if you don't go out now with an active strategy, so if you're not prepared to get a chainsaw in your hand, a paintbrush in your hand, do a splitter block, you won't get ahead. If you buy a property that you hope to be able to increase the rent on to make it cash flow neutral or positive, good luck. The rental market will take years to recover. So whatever rent we're at now, if we can hold that steady for the next 2 years, I'll be happy. And but that will obviously mean that if you go into you can't go and do a buy and hold strategy now, and you won't be able to do that. For anyone that says that they can predict suburbs or that, they're joking. In the next 2 years, that's not going to happen, mate. So people are going to have to roll up their sleeves. They're going to have to do something actively participating on that field of investing in property. And if you're not prepared to pick up a brush or to clean out a backyard you won't make any money. So there's lots of projects out there. We're super busy at the moment. We're very happy with the projects that we're pulling together. The finance discussions have been quite fruitful in the last month. I've probably raised more money in the last month than I've raised in my whole career. So I'm super happy with that. People are willing to be going to joint ventures right now. So I've got title holders that, funny enough, they're two ex-rugby league players that are super good touch footy players. I'm in a project with them. They've got titles, and so we've joint ventured. They're the title holders, and I've brought in money partners. I'll manage that project, obviously. So the conversations are easier to form joint ventures. There are people now realizing that they have to work with and through others. And so those conversations are better. It's a time of opportunity, but you've got to be able to see that opportunity. You've got to be able to work in a team, and you've got to be able to pick up a paintbrush if you need to. So there's a few things, the day of sit back. I mean, I don't talk about the Sydney and Melbourne markets because that literally is buy and it has been growing. So all of my comics, please, that excludes Sydney and Melbourne. But for the rest of Australia and southeast Queensland and rural areas, it is all about active investing. And that doesn't has to be that you have to do it by yourself. You can participate with other people in active investing, and that suits your listeners a lot. And it's not a whole new world. It's just that we have to get better at the active investing versus the passive investing, where we just went for depreciation and cash flow, and then they'd say, "Oh, wow, I made you 6% or whatever it was." I mean, yeah, those days are gone. So those spruikers are in real trouble. There's a lot of people on Facebook that pop out stuff that's not going to achieve people's goals at all. So it's a time for investors to be very wary of people promising them stuff. Get into the details, people, and have a look at the how it's going to happen, and do not rely on the market to deliver that. Deliver it yourself. Yeah.
No, I totally agree. We had Peter Kalizos. I don't know whether you've heard that name or not. And Michael Yardney. Michael had a different approach. But, I'm exactly of the same opinion that this whole idea of holding on to the titles and making money is going to disappear now. People who did it in the last 10, 20 years, it's worked well for them. That in the future, I just don't see how it can happen. It just doesn't make any sense, right, with the market the way it is now. And the interest rate's pretty much at zero. So
yeah, that's a great opportunity. So we've got threats on one hand. Michael's right. Like Michael's a very well-experienced investor, buyer's agent, runs great businesses, right? So, I think he still is a great believer of, buy in a city. So getting to that, in a 10 – so hence my comments, right? I do exclude. I don't want to go and risk $700,000 on one project, right? I want to still deal in the 500,000 range and make 40% in a year, right? So it's I don't want to go and buy a $700,000 property and wait 10 years for it to be maybe worth $1 million. It's probably likely to happen. I think Michael talks about that, right? He'll use the word likely, right? And he's right. I don't disagree with him at all. I am I'm a bit younger. I'm a bit more aggressive to make things happen on the ground versus sitting in a restaurant, enjoying the fruits of what happened 20 years ago for them. I miss that boat. I've always had to work hard for my projects and, roll up the sleeves. And I love that. I'm not ashamed of that. It's just – and I think we're – going to have to roll up the sleeves a little bit in the next 5 years, and those that do will be in the restaurant in 20 years' time with Michael, okay? So I do not disagree with him at all. In fact, I hope to join him one day, okay? So we are not poles apart on our opinions at all, okay? We're very similar. We're just a different age demographic and a few other things that have occurred in our lives, yeah. So.
Yeah. Right.
I think the concept that you had about, being smart and active and, being an active investor and look for that X factor value add strategy certainly works for Southeast Queensland. But I would also suggest all listeners that you should also keep that mindset when you're looking at Sydney and Melbourne properties. I mean, because that's essentially a safe buffer, in my opinion. I know, yes, the entry price is going to be higher, but looking and moving forward, like what Jazz has mentioned, like we both discussed on the podcast for a long time, we're both advocates for active investing. We both says you need to buy properties with an X factor rather than just a buy and hold, because what happened in the last 20 years doesn't guarantee what's going to happen in the next 20 years is going to be the same. So you always need to buffer yourself, have a plan, have something that you can actively deploy years down the track, if not immediately, to be able to manufacture that equity and growth. So, I totally think that expands into New South Wales and Victoria as well, not just Queensland.
100%, mate. 100%, mate. Yeah.
No, that's cool. With the on the development side of things, Dave, you already touched a little bit on this, but do you see any massive shift happening in that space as well post this whole coronavirus thing, where the type of developments that you guys have been doing or the whole concept of house and land packages kind of thing changing. If I'm a first home buyer or if I'm looking for my own principal place of residence, right, it can be debated, but I would start to question myself that if I'm buying it, let's assume that I'm buying it on cash, it's a $500,000 transaction, right? Why would I put my money into a principal place of residence, $500,000, which is kind of going to be a dead money? It's because we're not going to see that much growth, like we said, in future, and rather invest that money somewhere else where I can actually see the growth and just keep renting. Rent vesting is obviously a concept which is very popular.
It is. It is. Now, there's a few factors in there, though, Daz. I think I am a huge advocate that people get their own principal place of residence. So that's got to be their number one goal. It's the first way to build true wealth in your life. And there has to still have that goal. So if you're going to do rent vesting, which I love, okay, now that is so correct. If you're in Sydney and Melbourne, huge believer in rent vesting, which means you need to be renting smartly and living and cohabitating maybe with some other people for a while. While you're doing that, learn your property gear. Get into some joint ventures with some people that are working on some safe splitters, cosmetic rentals somewhere where you know you're going to be popping that equity out. You can then be smart with your financials. You don't have to sell anymore. You can release equity in those assets, and that equity can be used to build more assets. And when you get that cash flow going, so when you're, say, positive, say at $200 or $300 a week, so that's $1,000 a month, that $1,000 a month is going to effectively give you a $250,000 loan for free, right? So go for it then, right? Now you can go and buy smartly with your knowledge in a good spot in Sydney or Melbourne, do some work on that property. And by the way, your cash flow's helping you out massively. You've got that leg up then. You will accelerate past everyone else that didn't do that strategy. So good point. You got to watch that deposit, the amount of the deposit. I'm a little concerned about all the first homer grants and that are all targeted to the building industry to get them into those assets or those properties that, like you just mentioned, probably will not ever, never be an asset. So I think there's some policy concerns there. And then you got to get into something where you can create some value. So on the other hand, we're also looking at the change of demographics on the other end of the spectrum, which is we've now got a bunch of people that are heading into their 60s and onwards, and that's the market that I love. They have money, they've got sense, they've got experience, and those people know what they want, and they're entitled to it as well, where the young people that you mentioned about or first home buyers, they're going to have to sing a different tune in the next 5 years, unfortunately. So yeah, it's a tough journey at the moment for anyone that's 25 to get where they're going to have to get to. And I feel for them, and they're going to have to – it's a tough gig for them, right? So – but they can't rely on wealth transfer from their parents or grandparents. That may or may not happen. And that generation lived a different life. And but they're starting to retire right now. So our product placement is for them. We're very much working to this independent living program where we've got a joint venture with a building company called DC Living, where we're actually creating a bespoke product for that market. And it's so exciting for us, right? Because we're joint venturing with them. They're creating a wonderful product. We see all the value in it. It provides security. It provides title. It provides correct layout. It provides somewhere to put their caravan. These people are going to free up their contained wealth in their current situation. They'll put money in the bank. They'll have a caravan and a great secure house. And that's how they want to live for the next 30 years of their life. And we're designing for that to go into what we call interdependent living, where they work with, you know, Anglicare and services like that. So great situation now and a great opportunity. So we're not worried about COVID per se. Like we're more thinking about there are still great markets in the Australian market. And the best market right now to get into is the baby boomer market and what they're doing. So I refuse to look at first home buyers opportunity or ground or anything. You know, like, sorry, they'll need to do their cosmetic renos. They'll need to do their splitters and simple subdivisions. Mm-hmm. Happy, you know, we do that with the buyer's agency. But they've got to do their time. They're going to have to build that foundation underneath them. Bad luck. Sorry. It's they have to suck it up. And those that do will do extremely well in the rest of their life. But those that don't, well, you know, that's their choice right now. Okay. It's unfortunate, but that's life. So, but you know, the baby boomer generation is just about to flood out of their current situations, and they're desiring many things at the moment, but predominantly they desire security. So they want safety at their own house, but they want security of title. Mm-hmm. They want to own their own places, right? And they need places designed for them. And and they want to then enjoy it, and they will spend that $300 they put in the bank. So don't expect that coming through to the 20-year-olds, because they might go on cruise ships for the next 5 years, but they're going to do something else, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, let's see what COVID does to that slice of the market that frankly has all the wealth and the cash flow. So that's where we're highly positioned at the moment with our projects. Yeah.
One really good point over there, that the strategy, the way people are thinking, needs to change a little bit, even for the people who are planning to have their principal place of residence, especially if you're buying it on cash or something. There's a better way to utilize that cash, whether it's going actively into the development space, like with the joint projects on the baby boomer side, the kind of accommodation, aged care they need, or other different strategies, whether in the share market or wherever that it might be. But rather than buying your first home, that money, if it's cash, can be utilized a little bit better is the key point.
Completely agree with you. I think anyone that understands or needs to understand, you know, financial independence, you know, needs to get that point into their head really quickly, because you won't have financial independence unless they listen to you, you know, right now.
Just on the other side of it, where all these boomers are retiring, right? Do you see, and this is more at a macro level, me talking, but do you see with what's happened in the last couple of weeks with the prices in the real estate tanking a bit, overall transaction volume slowing down, and likes of the companies like Virgin Australia and oil prices this morning, I woke up and this is the first time I've
seen negative.
Oil futures in negative.
Well, the banks are full. You've got to understand that, right?
Oil future is sitting in negative. Like, what the F was that, right?
I've got to take some water out of my water tanks and put some oil in there, I reckon, because how funny is that situation? Yeah.
But looking at what's happening at the macro level, right, do you see that there is a risk that a lot of these boomers, baby boomers, will end up losing the wealth that they've created if the unemployment shoots right up, with these companies now slowly becoming insolvent, which is the way I call it is the first stage was the liquidation stage, where a lot of the money got liquidated. All the heavy leverage trading, both in property and the share market, they got wiped out. Now we are sitting in the hope stage where everything will recover. But the third stage is the reality stage, where the companies will become insolvent, which is your likes of Virgin Australia, and who else will show up tomorrow? Who knows? Maybe it's one of the banks, hopefully not, but maybe it is, right? But that could lead to a domino effect where these prices start to tank in the real estate heavily, and these boomers end up losing a lot of the wealth.
Yep. Let's focus a little bit on Sydney and Melbourne market for that answer.
Yep.
So those demographics, very much so, right? So they're all sitting on the, you know, $1.5 to $2.5 million properties. They all paid $150,000 for them. They really, do you think they care whether it tanks down to $1.3 million? You know, like, they've seen these cycles so many times, that generation. Now, our coffee worker generation, they've never seen this cycle, right? So so brand new for them. Virgin were already pretty insolvent before COVID happened anyway, right? 90% of that money is owned overseas. The oil price is a classic. That's based on people getting too sexy with futures, right? Buying a product that hasn't even been produced, right? Yeah. And you're selling it, you know, you buy it 4 months ago, you buy it in, you know, 2 months' time, okay? They're forwards. So that's okay. And that's physically because they're out of tanks, right? So I laugh about that stuff. I lived in that world in engineering, and you could see that stuff happening left, right, and center, right? That's financial engineering at a crazy investor bank level in New York and London coming through to affect the market. And that's okay. Yeah. So just come back to us for a second, though. In Australia, right, there's still money flowing around this economy big time. We've lost tourism. Tourism is a major problem, right? We've lost some dollars in the economy for the next year. We'll get local tourism, but it's never as good as international tourism. We need international tourism to find up, but that's a worldwide problem. Like, feel sorry for Italy, right? I mean, their whole economy is foreign tourism, right? So there's a few places that are going to really struggle. But if you come back to Australia, I don't think we've missed a shipment of coal, iron ore, or any of our minerals or metals out of Australia, right? I think we'll have some consumer recession going on. So there'll be a flow through to that, and that'll be okay. So we'll lose 15 to 20% of our stock levels, but that's okay. You know, we're not expanding any mines at the moment anyway, right? So it's all good, really. It'll just help flush out some of the stuff that we have. People will reskill. They'll get out of the tourism trade and into some value adding. You've got to realize people that work in there, they're only there stringent anyway while they're skilling up on other skills. That'll accelerate their desire to get their other skills. They'll head into automation, robotics. They'll head online to learn how to do online shops and learn how to be retailers instead of buyers, right? So they'll learn massive amount of innovation skills. They'll have to pivot. They'll have to roll up their sleeves. It's going to be a huge life lesson. In 12 months' time, they are going to be firing, right? They will come, that generation that everyone says is on their, you know, in the dole queue at the moment, give them 12 months and half of that queue will be doing their own business. They'll be learning business skills. They'll be learning all sorts of skills, right? And they'll be prepared to work with others. They'll be less arrogant. They will seek what they need to be resilient. Can I share what happened to me when I left uni?
Go for it.
Yep. I was the last of the recession, big time, right? So my year, three of us got jobs out of 35. We came out chemical engineering in 95. Three of us got work. And we were the three guys that were trainees, right? So we were working while we were at uni, okay? Now, that meant 32 people that had just done 4 years of study in their life didn't get an engineering job. You know, every year after that until probably, yeah, it's been full employment of engineering, okay? So that hurt. You know, I saw my first 2 years of my working life was in a smelter where they shafted just about every staff member out of the door, okay? And that left me scarred. And I've always been highly financially prudent because of that shocking experience I had when I was 21. So those that are 21 right now, yep, you've just seen all your mates lose your jobs in the coffee shops and the tourism industry. Yep, live with it and grow from it and use that to motivate you for the rest of your life. Because the government ain't going to help you, and they might say they're going to, but frankly, realize that sooner than later and get out there and get stuck into what you need to get into and rely on yourself and your teammates to get what you want to achieve. Sorry, yeah. Had to get that one out.
Great summary.
I think what you have mentioned just is that entrepreneurship will start coming out a lot in the next 12 months where people who have lost all their jobs and their youngsters, they'll start looking at different ways with all these new technologies that are AI or whatever it is. They'll start investing their time into that space. And that will bring out a lot more entrepreneurship rather than the lazy investors like us who just bought the properties and sat on them forever. Nobody's more lazy than I am. No, I'm the laziest one.
Yes, you're a shocker. But good point. Yeah, it's true.
And they'll also start thinking about the financial buffers. What do they need to do to be able to build that financial buffers moving forward? I think that's also a very important lesson, because what happens if another COVID hits again, right? How are they going to be able to safeguard themselves?
David, yeah. aren't you passionate about budgets?
Oh, totally.
Right.
I do them to a T.
How many people do you reckon have a budget right now in Australia? And I'll tell you, it's a lot more than it was a month ago.
100%. I mean, for the last 30 days, that number must have jumped and spiked, which is fantastic.
It's a good thing, isn't it? It's a very good
absolutely.
Thing.
Yes.
Moving away from property, mate, just some other good stuff in life. Aliens, believer or not?
Not.
It's a pretty big universe out there.
Well, I thought you were talking about the movies. You mean like, are there people that live in outer space? Yeah, probably. It's most likely, yes.
Most likely, yes. And do you think we'll see them in our lifetime? In our lifetime?
Ooh, wow. Hey, no.
Do you think they're as crazy as us about property?
Why else are they coming to Earth?
Next one. Crypto, here to stay or a fad?
Definitely here to stay. Crypto technology, not just in money, but we actually use it in our AI business with the mining automation. So definitely here to stay, that technology, yes.
So I had asked this question to pretty much in the last about 20 episodes, pretty much every guest who showed up on the show, I've asked him the question. I think you're the first or the second one who said, yes, it's definitely here to stay. Most said, yeah, blockchain technology is good, but all the cryptos are scams or fad and it will disappear at one point. So when you say you use it in your current day-to-day businesses, explain that a little bit more.
Oh, we have a resource automation business called Invelo.ai. My wife's the CEO. She's 50% owner of the business with Alan Bai. That's all about using AI to resource recovery. So whether we're talking about space, whether we're talking about agriculture, forestry, mining, which is our background big time, they all have to, especially now in the world of COVID, we're very rapidly going to go past Industry 4.0, which is automation, and we're going to go to Industry 5, which will be the big data. Now, that uses blockchain technology thinking a lot, significant, because you have to know where things have been going. It's a historical thing. So good point about currency of it, but it's definitely a technology that will lead to the next evolution. Blockchain's too cumbersome for currency. So there will be but it's broken the glass ceiling that everything has to be. Paper money is a fiat money anyway, right? Now that we don't have a gold standard, why does it matter if it's blockchain technology or some other digital standard, right? I mean, the Reserve Bank of Australia, for Christ's sake, just created, didn't they? How much was that? $5 billion or whatever they did? But they did that so subtly, right? So what's the difference? I mean, it's still zeros and ones, right? It doesn't matter whether you track it using blockchain technology, but cryptocurrency will have to come because you will only want to carry your phone around with you, and that little mini computer in your hand will have some sort of digital currency, and there will be people always that don't want to be limited to one country. So it's going to become a real tension between governance of a particular country versus a global economy. And I think the global economy will win out. There will have to be a global currency somehow. And that is what's going to get enabled by what we've experienced in the last 5 years, or actually, 15 years for blockchain money. So,
So that was one of my questions. Do you see any of these existing cryptocurrencies, whether it's Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ethereum, whatever they are, Ripple, becoming a global reserve currency?
Yeah, good question, because you would have to probably go with one that's already been created, but if it's got blockchain technology behind it, probably not. I think it's too cumbersome. One of those ones will have to change that tracking or creation of that currency. But it will be consumers who demand it, not the current people that will push it. So the government certainly won't want it, but the consumer will demand it within 10 years.
Yeah, so it's a free market, basically.
It's a free market. Doesn't matter what the Chinese government think they've got going on, but it's a free market.
Yeah. No, that's really good. Last question. Do you think we're in a simulation?
What?
it's consequence of watching too much Matrix, mate.
I was just thinking that, mate. Like, yeah, you know, sometimes it's like we're in a simulation, isn't it? And then, which pill would you choose, Jazz? Are you a red pill?
Red pill.
I'm going with a red pill for you, big fella.
Red pill. Red pill. So the answer is yes?
No.
Oh, it's the red pill. Look, David, good to have you on the show. I appreciate your time. There's a lot more stuff that we can discuss about what you have done in the development space, and I'm sure we'll bring you back on the show at some point to discuss that. There's a lot happening in the market currently, and it's impossible with your experience to fit all that in one episode. So we'll book some time out for that. And to our listeners, hope you guys are enjoying the content. And if you are, please don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or whatever app you're using, and let the word spread like a fire. Spark your fire. Cheers, David.
If you have any questions or feedback about today's episode, you can reach out to us through sparkyourfirepodcast@gmail.com. That's sparkyourfirepodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Also, the content discussed in this episode is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals in regards to your personal situation.